Today's show for December the 17th. We'll begin by a message from Michael Moore. A letter, Senate to the middle class, dropped dead. Friends, they could have given the loan on the condition that the automakers start building only cars and mass transit that reduces our dependence on oil. They could have given the loan on the condition that the automakers build cars that reduce global warming. They could have given the loan on the condition that the automakers withdraw their many lawsuits against state governments in their attempts to not comply with our environmental laws. They could have given the loan on the condition that the management team that drove these once great manufacturers into the ground resign and be replaced with a team who understands the transportation needs of the 21st century. Yeah, they could have given the loan for any one of these reasons, because in the end, to lose our manufacturing infrastructure and throw 3 million people out of work would be a catastrophe. But instead, the Senate said, we'll give you the loan only if the factory workers take a $20 an hour cut in wages, pension, and health care. That's right. After giving billions to Wall Street hucksters and criminal investment bankers, billions with no strings attached, and as we have since learned, no oversight whatsoever, the Senate decided it's more important to break a union, more important to throw middle-class wage earners onto the ranks of the working poor than to prevent the total collapse of industrial America. We have a little more than a month to go of this madness. As I sit here in Michigan today, tens of thousands of hard-working, honest, decent Americans do not believe they can make it to January 20th. The malaise here is astounding. Why must they suffer because of the mistakes of every CEO from Roger Smith to Rick Wagner? Make management and the board of directors and the shareholders pay for this. Of course, that's heresy to the 31 Republicans who decided to blame the poor, miserable auto workers for this mess. And our wonderful media complied with their spin on the morning news shows. UAW refuses to give concessions, killing auto bailout bill. In fact, the UAW had given concession after concession, reducing their benefits, agreed to get rid of the jobs bank, and agreed to make it harder for their retirees to live from week to week. Yes, that's what we need to do. It's the jobs bank and the old people who have led the nation to economic ruin. But even doing all that wasn't enough to satisfy the bastard Republicans. These Senate vampires wanted blood, blue-collar blood. You see, they weren't opposed to the bailout because they believed in the free market, or capitalism. No, they were opposed to the bailout because they're opposed to workers making a decent wage. In their rage, they were driven to destroy the backbone of this country, not because the UAW hadn't given back enough, but because the UAW hadn't given up. It appears that the sitting president has been looking for a way to end his reign by one magnanimous act, just like a warlord on his feast day. He will put his finger in the dike, and the fragile mess of an auto industry will eke through the next few months. They will give the Senate enough time to demand that the bankers and investment sharks, who've already swiped nearly half of the $700 billion gift, a chance to make the offer of cutting their pay. Fat chance. Yours, Michael Moore. The next one's from Greg Pallast. He calls it Obama's way to go brownie moment. He wrote for the Huffington Post. Has Barack Obama forgotten way to go brownie? Michael Brown was that guy from the Arabian Horse Association, appointed by George Bush to run the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Brownie, not knowing the south shore of Lake Pontchartrain from the south end of a horse, let New Orleans drown. Bush's response was to give his buddy Brownie a way to go thumbs up. We thought Obama would go a very different way. You'd think the studious senator from Illinois would avoid repeating the Bush regime's horror show of unqualified appointments, of picking politicos over professionals. But here we go again. Trial balloons lofted in the Washington Post suggest President-elect Obama is about to select Joel Klein as Secretary of Education. If not Klein, then draft choice number two is Arne Duncan, Obama's backyard basketball buddy in Chicago. Say it ain't so, President O. Let's begin with Joel Klein. Pallast then offers many reasons why Klein would be a bad choice, but in light of today's announcement, I'll skip that and go to Pallast's views on Obama's choice. The anti-teachers union establishment is a second stringer on the bench waiting in case Klein is nixed, Arne Duncan. Duncan, another lawyer playing at education, was appointed by Chicago's boss Daley to head that city's train wreck of a school system. Think of Duncan as Klein Light. What's Duncan's connection to the president-elect? Duncan was once captain of Harvard's basketball team and still plays backyard round ball with his Hyde Park neighbor, Obama. But Michelle has put a limit on their friendship. Obama was one of the only state senators from Chicago to refuse to send his children into Duncan's public schools. My information is that the Obamas sent their daughters to the elite laboratory school, where Duncan's teach the test pedagogy is dismissed as damaging and nutty. Mr. Obama, if you can't trust your kids to Arne Duncan, why hand him ours? Lawyer Duncan is proud to have raised test scores by firing every teacher in low-scoring schools. Which schools? Well, there's Collins High in the Lawndale ghetto, with children from homeless shelters and drug-poisoned hoods. They don't do well on tests. So Chicago fired all the teachers. They brought in new ones, then fired all of them, too. The teachers' reward for volunteering to work in a poor neighborhood. It's no coincidence that the nation's worst school systems are run by non-experts like Klein and Duncan. Obama certainly knows this. I know he knows because he's chosen as head of his education department transition team one of the most highly respected educators in the United States, Professor Linda Darling Hammond of Stanford University. So here we have the ludicrous scene of the president-elect asking this recognized authority, Dr. Darling Hammond, to vet the qualifications of amateurs, Klein and Duncan. It's as if Obama were to ask Michael Jordan, say, you wouldn't happen to know anyone who can play basketball, would you? It's not just Klein's and Duncan's empty credentials which scares me. It's the ill philosophy behind the Bush brand education theories they promote. Teach to the test, which goes under such prepackaging teaching brands as Success for All, forces teachers to limit classroom time to pounding in rote, low-end skills easily measured on standardized tests. The transparent purpose is to create the future class of worker drones. Add in some computer training and voila, millions trained on the cheap. To function, not think. Analytical thinking skills, creative skills, questioning skills will be left to the privileged at the laboratory school and Phillips Andover Academy. We hope for better from the daddy of Sasha and Malia. Educationally, the world is swamping us. The economic and social levees are bursting. We cannot afford another way-to-go brownie in charge of rescuing our children. That's the end of Palast's essay, and the postscript to this essay is it was announced this morning that Obama had, in fact, chosen Arne Duncan. Way to go, Barack. My commentary for today, December 17th. Please remember that you can tell your friends that if they want to hear this show, just go to kvmr.org. Right-hand side, go down to Program Schedule, then click on Rabble Rousing with Chamberlain, and many past shows are archived. You can listen at your convenience. You can tell your friends to listen. You can tell your enemies to listen. Okay, today's commentary. Well, those of you still believing that Barack Obama is the savior of our nation and that his appointees, along with the Democratic Party leadership of Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, will right all the wrongs of the Bush-Cheney disaster, they want to change channels now. I'm sure there are Mouseketeer reruns on cable somewhere. But for those of you that can handle a dose of realism, some of today's articles may enlighten. One can make the argument that Obama is not yet in office, and he will address these concerns once firmly in power. Maybe so, even though his appointees to date don't seem to indicate anything but more of the same under a new label. The issues that concern many citizens of all political leanings is that the Bush-Cheney gang gutted our Bill of Rights, trashed the U.S. Constitution, legalized torture, and took on powers of a virtual dictatorship. And Barack Obama has said not one word about reversing this trend. Not a word about the USA on Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, the negation of habeas corpus, and other affronts to our civil liberties. Yes, it seems Obama will close our torture center at Guantanamo, but there's no indication that he will cancel the onerous Bush-Cheney signing statements that allowed Guantanamo in the first place. Well, KVMR has the reputation of having a liberal bias. So, to carry on that grand tradition, I bring you an article from the publication of that noted liberal organization, the John Birch Society. It's called My 5 Minutes. Terrorists beware. Uncle Sam is listening to all 6.6 billion of you. It's by Thomas R. Edlam. While senators generally have unlimited time for debate, members of the U.S. House of Representatives often have only 5 minutes to make their point heard before a final vote on important legislation. after the U.S. Senate passed the latest amendment to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I thought about what I'd say if I had the chance to speak for 5 minutes before the assembled U.S. House of Reps, which was next on the legislative path for the bill. Here's what I'd say. The pending bill, already passed by the Senate, proposes to allow wiretap searches without warrants or probable cause. What this means in practical terms is that the federal government is going to be tapping the phones of people who are, by definition, probably not committing a crime. They're going to be tapping the phones of people who are probably law-abiding citizens. That's not only a colossal waste of law enforcement resources and effort, it's also blatantly unconstitutional. The Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution reads as follows. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath of affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. The Fourth Amendment sets forth a preamble of how it intends to protect the people from unreasonable searches, and then defines four tests needed for a search by the federal government to be constitutional. One, you need a warrant issued by a court. Two, the warrant needs to be based upon probable cause, meaning that there is more than a 50% chance a crime has been committed. Three, the warrant has to be supported by an oath. And finally, the warrant has to state specifically what is being searched for. Those aren't very high hurdles for a search to take place. Police officers at the state and local level have to surmount these hurdles every day for a much larger menu of crimes, and for the most serious crimes, such as murder. They don't wail about these requirements being unreasonable or making the people unsafe. But the president said in his February 16th weekly radio address that if he isn't given a pass by Congress to ignore the Constitution, we're all in danger. Quote, because Congress failed to act. He said, it will be harder for our government to keep you safe from terrorist attack. The president has essentially said that he can uphold the Constitution or he can keep America safe from foreign attacks, but he's not capable of doing both and would prefer the latter. If President Bush says he's not competent enough to adhere both to the limits of the Constitution's Fourth Amendment and keep America safe from foreign attack, like the presidents before him and police officials in every state and municipality, I'll take his word for it. But if that's the case, he should resign and let someone more competent take charge of the Oval Office. If his weekly radio address of February 16th is not an admission of incompetence, I don't know what such an admission would look like. I'm sure the White House doesn't like the legislature reading the Constitution its members swore an oath to uphold, or for that matter, critically analyzing President Bush's words against the lens of the Constitution. I know that perhaps some of my colleagues, and certainly White House legal officials, would say that I'm interpreting the Constitution incorrectly. And I do confess that I need an interpreter when I'm reading Latin or Greek. But the Constitution is written in simple, clear, declarative English sentences. While I don't speak Greek or Latin, I do speak and read the English language. I would ask my colleagues, Have you been in Washington so long that you now need an interpreter to read the simple English prose of our Constitution? I don't think that the American people need an interpreter either, unless it's for the double talk coming out of this city, and especially from the White House. And no, I don't need to revise or extend my remarks. This pretty much sums up the legislation. That was Thomas R. Edlam writing in The New American Magazine, which is the magazine of that liberal organization, the John Birch Society. Next item. Some state agency is proposing significant changes to state septic tank regulations that will force every owner of a septic system to pay to have it tested every 5 years and pay to have their well water tested every 3 years. I received an email about that, and I emailed the agency concerning my concerns about it, and I sent a copy to the local paper, the Grass Valley Union. If you have a septic system, you better pay attention to this issue, as if the state goes through with this proposal, it's going to cost you money. Here's my letter to the Grass Valley Union. The proposal is too broad in scope. It does not account for parcel size, the distance from septic tank to well, nor if well source is from aquifer directly beneath parcel or from rock fissures originating miles from the well. My septic tank is 20 years old and functions perfectly. My nose works just fine. I or my neighbors will know when and if my septic system fails. We don't need government to tell us. My well is several hundred feet from the tank, and it's fed from rock fissures 200 feet below ground level. No one has the slightest idea where the water originates that feeds these fissures. My health is the best test, and I don't need the state or county to verify my health or my water. Why should I have to pay for someone to test my water? This is just one more unnecessary and expensive intrusion of government into the lives of citizens. These regulations should properly be site-specific to areas needing such oversight, and not have to apply to all parcels in the state. I hope that anyone still thinking that KVMR has a liberal bias will recognize that my position on this issue is decidedly libertarian, conservative, private property rights. So there. Next item is from the CosmicPath.com. Hedge funds. They have enormous leverage on their investments, in some cases 1 to 400%. The investment houses have so much trouble. The investment houses having so much trouble, all fall, are only leveraged at 1 to 30. The hedge funds will be equivalent of the margin accounts in the 1929 crash. The hedge fund meltdown, when it happens, will be fast, sharp, and hard. It can start any time after December 28th this year, when Mars joins Pluto on the world axis and hedge funds begin to unwind before our eyes. When the hedge funds go to the financial market to sell for all the redemption calls they have been receiving this fall, the financial markets are going to collapse. So protect your principal. Get it all into cash or T-bills or gold now while you still can and before the stock markets collapse in January and February from the hedge funds unwinding. That's from thecosmicpath.com. Next item. This is from brasschecktv.com, which features videos of political interest, sort of like a political YouTube. A listener sent me one that featured farmers in India spraying cola drinks produced by both Coca-Cola and PepsiCo on their crops as pesticides. The practice is not a substitute for pesticides, as Indian government laboratories have determined that the cola drinks contain large percentage of pesticides, far above government limits. The farmers, being practical sorts, determined that spraying the cola drinks on their crops was far cheaper than spraying the more expensive agricultural pesticides. The video featured a farmer stating for the camera, "It is far cheaper than commercial pesticides, so we tried it and it seems to work." I caution that cola drinks are licensed by the American companies, Coca-Cola and Pepsi, to local companies, where they're then produced for the local market. So just because cola drinks in India are contaminated with pesticide does not mean these cola drinks are contaminated in other countries. On the other hand, since the American companies that license these products to be produced and sold worldwide obviously choose to have no quality control, you might want to think twice before indulging in your cola craving when traveling abroad. You never know what interesting ingredients flavor your cola. I do know that back in the 60s, when I hitchhiked through Panama, the Coca-Cola produced there still contained cocaine. I had a friend living there who was addicted to the locally produced Coca-Cola. You didn't know how Coca-Cola originally got its name? The word cola came from the cola nut. And coca? That's right. Now you know. And you might now understand why, when the parent company in Atlanta, Georgia, sells a license to produce their product abroad, they supply the concentrate, but keep the formula secret. You produce our product, but we supply the ingredients in a secret formula. Can one surmise that the formula changes according to the testing abilities and concerns of the government of that receiving country? If the foreign country isn't aware or doesn't mind cocaine in their cola, it's quite possible that the parent company doesn't mind either. It sure helps the bottom line. Next item. This one's hilarious. It's from tpmmuckraker.com, Bailout Overseer. We're still trying to get office space. It's by Natalie Sherman. Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard law professor who chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel, which is monitoring the Treasury's spending of the bailout money, appeared this afternoon before a House committee to testify about the report the panel released this morning. And from what Warren said, it doesn't appear the oversight of the billions of dollars at stake is being treated by either Treasury or Congress as a top priority. Warren told the committee that the panel's four members had met for the first time in 2 weeks ago, and we're still struggling to find office space. She added that all the members of the panel are serving part-time. Obviously, this group is a joke. There will be no oversight. So now we know how Congress is fearlessly overseeing the wasting of taxpayer money. I feel better now. Do you? Next item. BBC News announced that the OPEC oil cartel is meeting to get an agreement from its members to lower oil production in order to raise the world price of crude. It seems that the price is about one-third of what it was recently at its outrageous peak, and they claim they're in danger of unspecified miseries. I shed a tear over their plight until I realized that the price they're getting now is substantially above what it was only a few years ago, and their economies were doing superb at that price. The scam is back on, folks, and of course no one mentions the real reason for the wild range of crude oil prices. It has little to do with actual supply and demand. It has little to do with actual supply and demand, and everything to do with speculation on futures. Why have prices dropped recently? Could it be that the speculators have been so frightened by the ongoing financial crises worldwide that they've shied away from speculating on the oil market? What else could it be? The same oil's in the ground, and I ain't buying the myth that the world is suddenly consuming less oil. So there goes the myth of actual supply and actual demand determining the price you pay at the pump. To piggyback onto that story, let's lead into my next item. I'm sure many listeners have their own personal list of things they wish Barack Obama will change once he assumes power. The chances he will actually do anything significant are slim and none, but that's another story. Here's one of my wishes. On this morning's KVMR show, Brian Compton played a song titled, "You Can Make a Doubter Out of Jesus." My sleepy ears heard, "You Can Make a Dollar Out of Jesus." That sounded cool. So my suggestion for Obama is to make my rendition the new national anthem. The national obsession seems to be to try and make a dollar out of everything else, so why not admit it? Can't you just hear it now? The new and real American anthem, "Let's Make a Dollar Out of Jesus." And finally, this just in. According to the Alaskan Department of Fish and Game, while both male and female reindeer grow antlers in the summer each year, male reindeer drop their antlers at the beginning of winter, usually late November to mid-December. Female reindeer retain their antlers until after they give birth in the spring. Therefore, according to every historical rendition depicting Santa's reindeer, every single one of them, from Rudolph to Blitzen, had to be female. Actually, we should have known. Only women would be able to drag a fat old man in a red velvet suit all around the world in one night and not get lost. Okay, that's my commentary today. The time is 12:32 in the p.m. The station is KVMR FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is John Belaine. All right, this one is a special report by Robert Parry. I got it off of smirkingchimp.com. It's called Iran-Contra's Lost Chapter. As historians ponder... Oh, wait a second. We have a caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR. You're live on KVMR. Please turn down your radio.
I just want to thank you for your sense of humor.
Well, thank you. It's probably the most difficult part of my entire radio show is somehow managing to inject humor into the mess that we're in. So thank you for appreciating it.
We love it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Have a great day. All right. Iran-Contra's Lost Chapter, a special report by Robert Parry. As historians ponder George W. Bush's disastrous presidency, they may wonder how Republicans perfected a propaganda system that could fool tens of millions of Americans, intimidate Democrats, and transform the vaunted Washington press corps from watchdogs to lapdogs. To understand this extraordinary development, historians might want to look back at the 1980s and examine the Iran-Contra scandal's Lost Chapter, a narrative describing how Ronald Reagan's administration brought CIA tactics to bear domestically to reshape the way Americans perceived the world. That chapter was, quote, lost because Republicans on the congressional Iran-Contra investigation waged a rearguard fight that traded elimination of the chapter's key findings for the votes of three moderate GOP senators, giving the final report a patina of bipartisanship. Under that compromise, a few segments of the draft chapter were inserted in the final report's executive summary and another section on White House private fundraising. But the chapter's conclusions and its detailed account of how the perceptional management operation worked ended up on the editing room floor. The American people thus were spared the chapter's troubling finding that the Reagan administration had built a domestic covert propaganda apparatus managed by a CIA propaganda and disinformation specialist working out of the National Security Council. Quote, one of the CIA's most senior covert action operators was sent to the NSC in 1983 by CIA Director William Casey, where he participated in the creation of an interagency public diplomacy mechanism that included the use of seasoned intelligence specialists. Close quote. That was the chapter's conclusion. Further, this public-private network set out to accomplish what a covert CIA operation in a foreign country might attempt, to sway the media, the Congress, and American public opinion in the direction of the Reagan administration's policies. Close quote. However, with the chapter's key findings deleted, the right-wing domestic propaganda operation not only survived the Iran-Contra fallout, but thrived. So did some of the administration's collaborators, such as South Korean theocrat Sun Myung-moon, and Australian press mogul Rupert Murdoch, two far-right media barons who poured billions of dollars into the pro-Republican news outlets that continue to influence Washington's political debate to this day. Before every presidential election, Moon's Washington Times plants derogatory and often false stories about Democratic contenders, discrediting them and damaging their chances of winning the White House. For instance, in 1988, The Times published, the Times being the Washington Times of Sun Myung-moon, the Times published a bogus account suggesting that the Democratic nominee Michael Dukakis had undergone psychiatric treatment. In the year 2000, Moon's newspaper pushed the theme that Al Gore suffered from clinical delusions. For details, see Robert Perry's Secrets and Privilege. As for Murdoch, his giant news corporation expanded into American cable TV with the founding of Fox News in 1996. Since then, the right-wing network has proved highly effective in promoting attack lines against Democrats or anyone else who challenges the Republican power structure. As President George W. Bush herded the nation towards war with Iraq in 2002 and 3, Fox News acted like his sheepdogs, making sure the public opinion didn't sway too far off. The Fox effect was so powerful that it convinced other networks to load up with pro-war military analysts and to silence voices that questioned the invasion. The seeds of this private-public collaboration can be found in the 84-page draft Iran-Contra chapter titled Launching the Private Network. There appear to have been several versions of this lost chapter. This one I found in congressional files. The chapter traces the origins of the propaganda network to President Reagan's National Security Decision Directive 77 in January of 83, as his administration sought to promote its foreign policy, especially its desire to oust Nicaragua's leftist Sandinista government. As this article runs 6 pages, I'm going to omit several pages of details here. In its conclusion, the draft chapter read, the State Department was used to run a prohibited domestic covert propaganda operation, established despite resistance from the Secretary of State, and reporting directly to the NSC. The S/LPD attempted to mask many of its activities from Congress and the American people. However, the American people never got to read a detailed explanation of this finding, nor see the evidence. In October 87, as the Congressional Iran-Contra Committee wrote their final report, Republicans protested the inclusion of this explosive information. Though the Democrats held the majority, the GOP had leverage because Representative Lee Hamilton, Democrat of Indiana, the House chairman, wanted some bipartisanship in the final report, especially since senior Republicans, including Representative Dick Cheney of Wyoming, were preparing a strongly worded minority report. Hamilton and the Democrats hoped that three moderate Republicans, William Cohen of Maine, Warren Rudman of New Hampshire, and Paul Tribble of Virginia, would break ranks and sign the majority report. However, the Republicans objected to the draft chapter about Ronald Reagan's covert propaganda campaign. As part of a compromise, some elements of the draft chapter were included in the executive summary, but without much detail and shorn of the tough conclusions. However, the failure of the Iran-Contra report to fully explain the danger of CIA-style propaganda intruding into the U.S. political process would have profound future consequences. Indeed, the evidence suggesting that today's powerful right-wing media gained momentum as part of the Casey Rudman operation of the early 1980s. So let me stop to remind people that whenever the Congress talks of bipartisanship, it probably is not in the interest of the American people. It's probably BS. On with the article. In the two decades since the Iran-Contra scandal, both Murdoch and Moon have continued to pour billions of dollars into media outlets that have influenced the course of U.S. history, often through the planting of propaganda and disinformation, much like a CIA covert action might do in a hostile foreign country. Further, to soften up the Washington Press Corps, this is Otto Reich, his organization targeted U.S. journalists who reported information that undermined the pro-Contra propaganda. Reich sent his teams out to lobby news executives to remove or punish out-of-step reporters, with a disturbing degree of success. Some U.S. officials implicated in the Iran-Contra propaganda operation are still around, bringing the lessons of the 80s into the new century. For instance, Elliot Abrams, though convicted of misleading Congress in the Iran-Contra affair and later pardoned by President George H.W. Bush, Abrams is now deputy advisor to George W. Bush, the NSC, where he directs U.S. Middle East policy. Bob Kagan remains another prominent neocon theorist in Washington, writing op-ed pieces for the Washington Post. Oliver North was given a news show on Fox. Otto Reich is now advising Republican presidential candidate John McCain on Latin American affairs, and Lee Hamilton is a senior national security advisor to Democrat Barack Obama. Beyond these individuals, the manipulative techniques that were refined in the 80s, especially the skill of exaggerating foreign threats, have provided durable, bringing large segments of the American population into line behind the Iraq War. Only now, with more than 4,100 U.S. soldiers and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead, are many of these Americans realizing they were manipulated by clever propaganda and their perceptions had been managed. For instance, the New York Times recently pried loose some 8,000 pages of Pentagon documents revealing how the Bush administration had manipulated the public debate on the Iraq War by planting friendly retired military officers on TV news shows. Retired Green Beret Robert S. Beklava, a former analyst on Murdoch's Fox News, said the Pentagon treated the retired military officers as puppets. Quote, "It was them saying, we need to stick our hands up your back and move your mouth for you." Bush's former White House press secretary, Scott McClellan, described similar use of propaganda tactics to justify the Iraq War in his recent book. From his insider vantage point, McClellan cited the White House's, quote, "carefully orchestrated campaign to shape and manipulate sources of public approval," close quote. And he called the Washington Press Corps complicit enablers. None of this would have been so surprising. Indeed, Americans might have been forewarned and forearmed if Lee Hamilton and other Democrats on the Iran-Contra Committee had held firm and published the scandal's lost chapter two decades ago. That was by Robert Parry. This one is by Paul Craig Roberts, and this is in the American Free Press. The Democrats and civil liberties, will they turn a blind eye to the destruction of the Bill of Rights? Unless November's new blood improves the Democratic Party's civil liberties pedigree, the Democrats will have failed even before they're sworn in next January. In its disregard for truth, public opinion, the separation of powers, the Geneva Convention, the U.S. Constitution, and statutory law, the Bush administration has been more of a regime than an administration. The Bush-Cheney executive branch has operated independently of all of the constraints that provide accountability and prevent despotism. The Bush regime was able to evade these restraints because Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and because Republicans wielded 9/11 as a weapon to forestall political opposition. With signing statements and other unilateral declarations of presidential authority, the Bush regime asserted executive branch powers beyond the reach of Congress and the judiciary. The Bush regime was a coup d'etat against the Bill of Rights and the jurisdiction of Congress and the courts. Unless Democrats roll back this coup, Americans have seen the last of their civil liberties. Judging by Democrats' statements in the flush of their electoral victory, Democrats have little, if any, awareness of this critical fact. Democrats are anxious to get on with their agendas and have shown no recognition that the first order of business is to repeal the legislation that permits torture, warrantless detention, and domestic spying. If Bush threatens to veto the resurrection of U.S. civil liberties, the Democrats can impeach Bush as a tyrant, as well as for pushing America into an illegal and catastrophic war on the basis of lies and deception. Bush is the most impeachable president in American history. However, the incoming Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has declared impeachment to be off the table. Obviously, this means that Bush will not be held accountable and that the Bill of Rights is a casualty of the vague, undefined, and propagandistic war on terror. Do Pelosi and the incoming Senate Majority Leader Harry B. Reid have the intellect and character to deliver the leadership required for Americans to remain a free people? Instead of bemoaning the damage Bush has done to civil liberty, Democrats are up in arms over one child in five being raised in poverty. The more important question is whether children are being raised as a free people, protected by civil liberties, from arbitrary government power. Do Democrats share the delusion of Bush supporters that it is only Middle Eastern terrorists who are deprived of the provision and protection of the U.S. Constitution? One can understand the reluctance of Americans to extend conditional protection. One can understand the reluctance of Americans to extend constitutional protection to terrorists who are trying to kill Americans. However, without these protections, there is no way of ascertaining who is a terrorist. Currently, a terrorist is anyone given that designation by any of the large number of unaccountable government officials and military officers. No evidence has to be provided in an order to detain a designated suspect. Moreover, designated suspects can be convicted in military tribunals on the basis of secret evidence not made available to them or to any legal representation that they might be able to secure. In other words, you're guilty if charged. As the case of U.S. citizen Jose Padilla makes clear, these Gestapo police state proceedings apply to Americans. Padilla was declared to be an enemy combatant. He was held in a U.S. prison for 3.5 years with no charges and no warrant. He was kept in solitary confinement, tortured, and denied legal representation. In order to avoid U.S. Supreme Court jurisdiction over the case, the Bush regime filed charges after stealing 3.5 years of Padilla's life. However, the charges have no relationship to the Bush regime's original allegations that Padilla, a Hispanic American, was an al-Qaeda operative who was going to set up a radioactive dirty bomb in an American city. The U.S. government no longer designates Padilla as an enemy combatant. The dirty bomb charge has disappeared, and U.S. Federal District Judge Marcia Cook has criticized the government's indictment as vague, with sketchy evidence, weak on facts. The reason that the Bush regime wants to detain people indefinitely without evidence is that it has no evidence. The reason the Bush regime passed torture legislation is in order to produce the missing evidence by torturing a suspect into self-incrimination. Evidence produced by torture has been illegal in civilized societies for centuries, but the Bush regime has resurrected the medieval rack and substituted it for the Bill of Rights. If Democrats cannot bring themselves to rectify the inhuman and barbaric practices that now pass for U.S. justice, then they, too, have failed the American people. Paul Craig Roberts, who served in the administration of the first Bush. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Okay, hi.
You're live on KVMR.
Is this Tamba?
I hope so.
Okay, hey, Tamba, I don't know if you heard the Glenn Ifill. We have to hold National Public Radio responsible for the media, the corporate shutdown on the Bush administration. Last night on Newsline, Glenn Ifill interviewed two gentlemen that have written a book on how to reinvent the Republican Party. And they were all sitting around asking each other why they thought the Republicans lost this last time around, and they didn't mention George Bush's name. And it was just astounding. It's like the three of them couldn't figure out why the Republicans lost. And at no time did they mention the corruption of the Bush regime. And this is Glenn Ifill with NewsHour on NPR.
Okay, that tells us where NPR is at, doesn't it?
Exactly. So great show, and thanks again for all your great work.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, let's take a turn on the wild side. You want bizarre? I'll give you bizarre. I'm no scientist, so I have no idea what this guy's writing about, but I find it interesting. Perhaps you will, too. The article was piggybacked onto an article offering an explanation of how the World Trade Center towers fell, i.e., not by controlled demolition, and certainly not by fires from jet fuel, but by particle beam weaponry, as developed by the HAARP project. Here's the article. I read, you decide. What exactly is the Hutchison effect? It's written by Mark A. Solis. People often ask, what exactly is the Hutchison effect? This brief essay is an attempt to answer that question to the satisfaction of the majority. First of all, the Hutchison effect is a collection of phenomena which were discovered accidentally by John Hutchison during attempts to study the longitudinal waves of Tesla back in 1979. In other words, the Hutchison effect is not simply a singular effect. It's many. The Hutchison effect occurs as a result of radio wave interference in a zone of spatial volume encompassed by high voltage sources, usually a Van de Graaff generator and two or more Tesla coils. The effects produced include levitation of heavy objects, fusion of dissimilar materials such as metal and wood, exactly as portrayed in the movie The Philadelphia Experiment, the anomalous heating of metals without burning adjacent material, spontaneous fracturing of metals, which separate by sliding in a sideways fashion, and both temporary and permanent changes in the crystalline structure and physical properties of metals. I'm going to interrupt this to mention to our listeners that if anybody is curious about any of this, a wonderful old movie is called The Philadelphia Experiment. It's fascinating. You might think it's science fiction, but over the years, there's been enough people that come out of the woodwork that claim that it actually happened. So I suggest that if you want a good entertainment, see if your video store has The Philadelphia Experiment. Back to the article. The levitation of heavy objects by the Hutchison effect is not, repeat, not the result of simple electrostatic or electromagnetic levitation. Claims that these forces alone can explain the phenomena are patently ridiculous and easily disproved by merely trying to use such methods to duplicate what the Hutchison effect has achieved, which has been well documented both on film and videotape and has been witnessed many times by numerous credentialed scientists and engineers. Challengers should note that their apparatus must be limited to the use of 75 watts of power from a 120-volt AC outlet, as that is all that is used by Hutchison's apparatus to levitate a 60-pound cannonball. The fusion of dissimilar materials, which is exceedingly remarkable, indicates clearly that the Hutchison effect has a powerful influence on van der Waals forces. In a striking and baffling contradiction, dissimilar substances can simply come together, yet the individual substances do not dissociate. A block of wood can simply sink into a metal bar, yet neither the metal bar nor the block of wood come apart. Also, there's no evidence of displacement, such as would occur if, for example, one were to sink a stone into a bowl of water. Again, if you see the movie The Philadelphia Experiment, it depicts exactly that as having happened. Back to the article. The anomalous heating of metal without any evidence of burning or scorching of the adjacent materials, usually wood, is a clear indication that possibly the nature of heat may not be completely understood. This is a far-reaching implication for thermodynamics, which hinges entirely on the presumption of such knowledge. It should be noted that the entirety of thermodynamics is represented by the infrared portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. The anomalous heating exhibited by the Hutchison effect shows plainly that we have much to learn, especially where thermodynamics and electromagnetism meet. The spontaneous fracturing of metals, as occurs with the Hutchison effect, is unique for two reasons. One, there is no evidence of an external force causing the fracturing, and two, the method by which the metal separates involves a sliding motion in a sideways direction horizontally. The metal simply comes apart. Some temporary changes in the crystalline structure and physical properties of metals are somewhat reminiscent of the spoon bending of Uri Geller, except that there is no one near the metal samples when the changes take place. One video shows a spoon flapping up and down like a limp rag in a stiff breeze. In the case of permanent changes, a metal bar will be hard at one end, like steel, and soft at the other end, like powdered lead. Again, this is evidence of strong influences on van der Waal forces. The radio wave interferences involved in producing these effects are produced from as many as four or five different radio sources, all operating at low power. However, the zone in which the interference takes place is stressed by hundreds of kilovolts. It is surmised by some researchers that what Hutchison has done is tap into the zero-point energy. This energy gets its name from the fact that it is evidenced by oscillations at 0 degrees Kelvin, where supposedly all activity in an atom ceases. The energy is associated with a spontaneous emission and annihilation of electrons and positrons coming from what is called the quantum vacuum. The density of the energy contained in the quantum vacuum is estimated by some at 10 to the 13th joules per cubic centimeter, which is reportedly sufficient to boil off the Earth's oceans in a matter of moments. Given access to such energies, it's small wonder that the Hutchison effect produces such bizarre phenomena. At the present time, the phenomena are difficult to reproduce with any regularity. The focus for the future, then, is first to increase the frequency of occurrence of the effects, then to achieve some degree of precision in their control. The work is continuing at this time. Before long, we shall see what progress can be made. As I said, this article was piggybacked onto an article claiming that the World Trade Center towers were destroyed by advanced weaponry, particle beam weapons, and it's a very lengthy article, and it contains much supposed evidence that that is actually what happened. I'll leave that link on my website. So if you look at the at this week's show, the blurb for this week's show, which will be up in maybe less than a week, you will be able to read about it. And you will confound yourself. And you will say, oh my goodness. This is why you don't take men to the store with you. After I retired, my wife insisted that I accompany her on her trips to Target. Unfortunately, like most men, I found shopping boring and preferred to get in and out. Equally unfortunately, my wife is like most women. She loved to browse. Yesterday, my dear wife received the following letter from the local Target. Dear Mrs. Samsel, over the past 6 months, your husband has been causing quite a commotion in our store. We cannot tolerate this behavior and have been forced to ban both of you from the store. Our complaints against Mr. Samsel are listed below and are documented by our video surveillance cameras. June 15th, he took 24 boxes of condoms and randomly put them in people's carts when they weren't looking. July 2nd, set all the alarm clocks and housewares to go off at 5-minute intervals. July 7th, made a trail of tomato juice on the floor leading to the woman's restroom. July 19th, walked up to an employee and told her in an official voice, Code 3 in housewares, get on it right away. August 4th, went to the service desk and tried to put a bag of M&Ms on layaway. August 14th, moved a caution wet floor sign to a carpeted area. August 15th, set up a tent in the camping department and told other shoppers he'd invite them in if they would bring pillows and blankets from the bedding department. August 23rd, when a clerk asked if they could help him, he began crying and screamed, Why can't you people just leave me alone? September 4th, looked right into the security camera and used it as a mirror while he picked his nose. September 10th, while handling guns in the hunting department, he asked the clerk where the antidepressants were. October 3rd, darted around the store suspiciously while loudly humming the Mission Impossible theme. October 6th, in the auto department, he practiced his Madonna look by using different sizes of funnels. October 18th, hid in a clothing rack, and when people browsed through, yelled, Pick me! Pick me! October 21st, when an announcement came over the loudspeaker, he assumed a fetal position and screamed, Oh no, it's those voices again! And last but not least, on October 23rd, he went into a fitting room, shut the door, waited a while, and then yelled very loudly, Hey, there's no toilet paper in here. Okay. That's it for today.